You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Wednesday, so it's time for Wayne on Wednesday. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. Wayne, there's been a lot of chatter on Twitter, and you have been featured in a lot of that chatter because people, you know, as things are relatively quiet. When I say relatively, I mean relatively quiet. And people are going on about the, do you put your money offshore with the Rand where it is, or do you start to look at undervalued or perceived undervalued valuations for SA Inc. stock? So it's been quite lively stuff. You've been quite active on Twitter yourself.
Yeah, look, I've learned a few things about being in the public domain, for want of a better word.
Yes.
Half the people love you, half the people hate you, and the half that hate you are far more vocal than the half that love you.
Quite right.
So I don't look at replies to my tweets. I don't reply to anyone. I've always maintained that because it will just make you depressed. And then secondly, you can get into Twitter wars with people, and that's not. So I just post my tweets or my, what they're called now, my X's.
Yeah, I haven't noticed. Mine hasn't changed to X yet. As yours, have you?
No. It's apparently only on your PCs now, as far as I understand. I'm not entirely sure why. But I mean, it is at some stage will all change to X. So, but anyway, to get back to the point.
Yes.
So I don't really look at and follow any Twitter conversations. I'm a bit cautious about doing that because there's a lot of very negative things on Twitter, and I just don't want to become involved. But anyway, to come back to your question.
I agree with you, by the way, about that. Yeah. Never, ever fall into the trap of going back to somebody because then you open up a whole can of worms. But anyway, back to my point about SA Inc. Yes. versus getting money overseas.
Look, over time, you will probably want, excluding your house now, okay, let's just put, because that's in South Africa, and I'm only talking about South Africans now. Excluding your house,
right,
you would probably want 60 to 80% of your money with overseas exposure, non-Rand exposure. That doesn't mean taking the money overseas. As we've spoken about many times, there's plenty of non-Rand exposure on our JSE. In fact, the JSE is 70% non-Rand exposure, if you like to look at it that way.
Okay.
But it's very critical that you get the timing right on when you buy that global exposure. And what happens is we all human, and we just want to get money overseas when there's chaos and mayhem and panic in South Africa and in the markets. Now, we come across this on a very, very regular occurrence. You know, it's every 5 years, every 4 years in South Africa, whatever the thing is, the Rand just collapses in front of your eyes and you get panicked and you get talk about the failed state and blah, blah, blah. And then you rush with your money overseas and then you regret it in 2 years' time because the Rand has strengthened. So now the best example by far was 2002. Where the Rand collapsed. You know, we had just come through that big transition in South Africa where we got rid of the financial Rand, where we cut all of our import tariffs. The Rand had to collapse during the 90s because it was artificially valued during the 80s by the apartheid government because we had full exchange control. We all know that. So the Rand had a terrible 1990s as it adjusted to the correct level, for want of a better word. Then everyone, you just wanted non-Rand exposure. You got as much money overseas. You bought as many assets. I know a good few people who became names at Lloyd's in London because there was one way you could get non-Rand exposure without worrying about exchange control. And then remember all those, what was the company's names? Trencor and all of their containers that were
used out
in dollars.
It was a container business.
It was a huge thing, a container business, and everyone panicked. And you know, if you went overseas at that stage and you put your money in dollars, it took you 8 years to get your money back in rands and almost 14 years to get your money back if you put that money you took overseas into the stock market. Remember, the U.S. market did nothing for 10 years, from the dot-com bubble bursting to just before 2008 or something. It was almost 10 years where you got zero capital return on your dollar assets, and the rand strengthened from, I think it was about 12 rand, 13 rand, 2002, went down to 6 rand 50. You know, so to come back to current, the rand weakens. We've just seen it now. It's gone to 20. It's now back at, what, 1760, 1750, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
1770. And I think it's going to go below 17 and 1650, maybe even 16 over the next 2 years on absolutely normal cyclical events. Interest rates will fall, global growth will pick up, inflation will fall and give us a bit of an upcycle in commodities, and the platinum and the palladium and the iron ore price and the coal price will go up. The rand will strengthen under that environment. Then you go overseas. So I would think, if you want to take money overseas, anything under 17, which isn't that far away now, 1760 at the moment,
yes,
you start taking money overseas. And if it gets to 16, I don't know, maybe it will, maybe it won't, I don't know. But if it gets towards 16, you must have taken your money that you wanted to overseas, and then you'll enjoy the benefits of rand weakness. The rand is a weak currency. You know, it is... maybe not as weak going into the future as what has been in the past, because our inflation differentials are far closer now than what they've been in previous decades. But still, you virtually guaranteed over long time periods 5%, 6% rand weakness on a sustained basis with your money overseas. And of course, overseas, there are far better assets to choose from and that are available overseas and in South Africa and our stock market. But then to come to the pockets of value now. So that's the rand argument. That's how I say, don't take your money overseas now.
Before you go on, though, this is something that you shouldn't do. And I've always been told by people as clever as you, maybe not quite as clever as you, but nearly as clever as you, don't become a rand trader. And it almost sounds to me, Wayne, as though you're becoming a rand trader, a rand predictor.
No, you must take your rand out at the right time.
That's the same thing.
Because the biggest damage, I've seen people get destroyed and lose a lot of money and actually become destitute by making two or three wrong decisions, like buying the dot-com in 2002 when everyone was buying it,
yes,
like buying the platinum shares in 2008 when everyone was buying it, like buying Bitcoin when it was 68,000 because everyone was buying it. And I've also seen people make huge mistakes by taking their money out when the rand is collapsing around your ears and is significantly undervalued. So in other words, simplistically now, every 4 to 7 years, roughly speaking, the rand becomes excessively cheap and excessively expensive. All I'm saying is, take your money out when it's expensive, not when it's cheap.
And how do you gauge that? I mean, are you one of these people that looks at, for example, the 200-day moving average or the mean of the rand on a five-year graph or something like that? I mean, you must have a model that you work on when it comes to the rand.
Yes, I do have a model, but it's got nothing to do with technical analysis or moving averages. I actually think personally, and I can pick up huge flack for it, I think that's an aberration in investments. I don't think technical analysis and moving averages and this has actually got a place in investments, but that's just my view. But besides that, I don't actually predict the rand. I predict the commodity cycle, because the rand is a commodity currency and the rand follows the commodity cycle. If you take out inflation, the rand follows the commodity cycle almost perfectly. So I'm actually a predictor of the commodity cycle. And then, according to my view, by definition, then, the rand cycle, because we're a commodity exporter. So I've done quite a few studies on this. If you take the rand-dollar exchange rate and you take inflation out of the picture, in other words, if you make the assumption that our inflation is the same as the US and you take that out of the decrease in the value of the rand, what's left over is the commodity cycle. is actually very, very few, surprisingly enough, very, very few other influences. Domestic politics obviously does affect the rand, but it affects it over very short time periods, you know, 1 or 2 years, if that. And so in other words, if you take the rand dollar and you take out the inflation cycle, and then you take out the commodity cycle, and what's left there is South African issues. And sometimes it affects the rand negatively, sometimes it affects the rand positively. But over 5-10 year time periods, that influence is null. It's very volatile in the shorter term, but over longer time periods, it's actually null. So I try and predict as well as what anyone else can, because no one knows the future, what the commodity cycle is going to do. So in other words, right now, I mean, if you take, you can take any commodity. We're at the bottom of the cycle now. They shot up like crazy just after COVID, and that's why the platinum companies made absolute fortunes. But in the last year and a half or whatever the time period is, commodity prices have collapsed. And commodity cycle is dependent on the interest rate cycle, which is dependent on the inflation cycle. So in fact, I'm just calling inflation.
And it's also dependent on China. And one thing that I've noticed, there's been some changes at the top of the administrators in China in the last 2-3 days. And I think there's going to be more stimulus. And I think they're going to be buying again as soon as that stimulus starts to come through. So the China factor is also terribly, terribly important, don't you think?
And the China factor is going to play into the falling interest rates and falling inflation and falling interest rates will play into that, because that's positive for commodities. The China stimulation will be positive for commodities. And what's equally as important is commodity companies haven't invested in new production capacity since 2015. Mm. In fact, 2013. So you're going to get, I think, quite a good commodity upcycle, because almost all the ducks are aligned there for a reason. It's going to be nothing like the 2000 to 2008, the big China years. But I think we could get quite a nice commodity cycle coming, which means quite a nice strong rand, et cetera, et cetera. Now, pockets of value in South Africa. Let's divide the South African market into global shares, which has got nothing to do with South Africa. Then mining shares, which effectively, other than the platinum mines and a few other scattered, are global companies. And then South African shares. Now, I'm the most enthusiastic, my most positive outlook for shares is actually mining shares for the next 3 to 4 years. They might be listed here, but they're not South African. Then to answer the question after a long, long route, detour,
mm-hmm.
very long detour, there are some small pockets of value in South African shares, but these are very, in terms of market capitalization, these things are smaller. So you can pick a couple of banks. They still show value. Maybe you can be a little bit adventurous and pick one or two retailers. Maybe Spar shows a bit of value. Maybe Pick and Pay shows a bit of value. ShopRite, even though they had spectacular results, I don't think that shows huge value. And then you get the truly small cap shares that might also be showing pockets of value. So to answer the question, other than banks and a couple of retailers, my big bet for the next 3 years is mining shares, and that's not South Africa. That's global.
Okay.
Global exposure.
And that's good. So what you're doing at the moment, I don't know if you've ever been a sailor, but there's something called the doldrums, which is a particular weather system. Maybe it's gone out the window.
I know the doldrums very well.
Exactly. So you're in the doldrums where nothing happens. The sea is flat and calm and there's no wind. You're not going anywhere. You can put up as many sails as you like, but you're not going to go anywhere. And it seems to me that the market is sort of in the doldrums at the moment. It's a Northern Hemisphere summer. I mean, where I live, the whole town in which I inhabit is full of Germans, Belgians, French, and a smattering of local tourists from the north, Dutch tourists. So everyone's whooping it up. It's school holiday time, and it's a little bit quiet. So looking at my screen today, and I'm looking at trying to find some news. There's not really that much. What do you do during this time? Do you just sit on your hands and say, I'm positioning myself for all of the reasons that I've just told that Lindsay Williams fellow? Is that what you do?
Look, I actually think for let's call people like myself professional investors, although I don't like the word professional at all, because the word professional implies that you're going to get it night, you're going to get it right 98% of the time, and you don't.
Well, you know, it implies you get don't. Paid for what you do. That's where. If I'm a professional I'm getting paid for it.
Besides that,
yeah.
Let's just take professional investors and Joe Public, Jane Public, the private investor. We are our own worst enemies when it comes to making investment decisions. We're emotional, and we react to that emotion. So to answer your question, everyone, professional and the proverbial man in the street, woman in the street, should spend most of their time doing nothing in investments. Should be sitting on your hands 90% of the time. And let me tell you, when you do make a move. So most of the time, hug your index, hug your benchmark, take a little bit there, maybe a tiny little bit of a bet there, because you can't do absolutely nothing. So, you know, you take a small posse here, a small posse there. You like this share, you up it a bit. You don't like that, you down it a bit. But essentially, you track your index, whether it's the all share or the capped or whatever index you got, inflation plus 3, and be well diversified. So in other words, 90% of the time, effectively, you're going along with the market. And you can buy an index if you want to. That's also fine. You're going, but then that 10% of the time, very unique opportunities arise. Either the market's too expensive or it's too cheap. Now, to tell whether a market's too expensive is by far the more difficult of the decision. Because when the market's expensive, you only hear good news. You just hear good news. The market is just going up. That's all it's going to do. You are swimming in good news. In fact, you're drowning in good news. To buy is a far easier decision. Because when the market falls 40%, you just buy. But of course, you don't want to, because the world is coming to an end and the markets are collapsing around your ears and you are drowning in bad news. So as I was saying, our human personality is our worst asset when it comes to making investment decisions.
Well, on the other hand, if you've got the time and the patience and you are a professional investor and you're at a large institution, as you are, you say to yourself, okay, I'm buying platinum stocks now. I'm buying PGM stocks listed on the JSE Securities Exchange, which you were doing 3-4 months ago. And they did very, very well for the first month or so. And they've come
and
back again now. But then you
just
keep on going. But it doesn't matter. You're not going to worry. You're not a retail investor trading a contract for difference or an ETF or anything. You're not a short-term trader.
No.
So you don't care. Well, you do care, but I mean, the point is that when you look 3 or 4 years' time and you look back at this conversation, you said, okay, I got the first 10-15% wrong, but on the other hand, I got the next 60-70% right.
Look, as I was talking about earlier on human personality and how it's your worst asset when it comes to investing. Now, me personally, I'm an impulsive person. I like to do things. I like to, let's do it. Let's just go out there, and if we get it wrong, we'll try it again. You know, and eventually we'll get it right. But so I know one of my biggest faults in investing is buying too early. So when something to me looks like value and I think it's good, I buy it. And I generally buy too early. So if I'm right in the decision, it doesn't matter if I buy too early. If ultimately my decision is right. But you can suffer quite dramatically in the shorter term. Now, a classic example that I made this mistake myself.
Yes.
This was, when was it? 2013, 2014, somewhere around there. Kumba Iron Ore. And I'm just using Kumba as an example, but they're all the same. You can use Anglos, you can use all of those shares. Kumba Iron Ore fell from about $600 and it just fell. I didn't own any Kumba at 600 because I sold almost all the commodity shares in 2008 on the back of the global financial crisis. I got out near the top, thank goodness. Okay, so Kumba fell from $600 and it fell and it fell and it fell and it fell and it fell. And I thought, at 100 Rand, this is a steal. And
I've
bought.
I've heard this
and
story.
Where did
it's a
go
good
to?
Story. Yeah. And it fell to what,
25? 25 Rand.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't sell. Next stop was almost 800. So it didn't matter whether I bought it at 100 or 25, made no difference whatsoever. But that, and I always say to myself, when I get a good idea, I must write it in the, put it in my diary and act on it in 6 months' time. Because I always go in before the share hits the bottom. But understand, that in itself is almost irrelevant if your end decision is right. And if you've got a diversified portfolio and you get two or three things wrong, it doesn't kill you.
Well, Wayne, all I can say is that, you know, as you've become almost a part-time worker these days, from what I understand from the conversations that we've had, and the fact that you have a hobby, you know, with motor cars, etc., it's much easier for you to sit on your hands than these young chaps or younger chaps that are sitting there saying, what should I be doing? I must be doing something. I've got to sort of justify my existence at this desk. And they get nervous about it. So they start fiddling.
Yeah.
And that's when Rome burns.
Yeah.
So you're in a lucky position.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're in a lucky position.
Now, look, I mean, I've always been a reasonably hard-working character. I've always quite enjoyed work.
Right.
And I was an accountant. And in accountant, you worked 16 hours a day because there was work and it had to be done. And you had to get an output, and you did it. Then when I came into investments, it was quite a shock to realize that you don't have to actually do anything. You got to do research, you got to inquire, you got to find out, you got to read, you got to think, you've got to do research, et cetera, as I said. But you don't have to actually do anything. You know, you're not paid to make 400 widgets a day. You're not paid to do that. No, you're paid to ultimately make good investment decisions. And just another thing, just a little side comment. Mm-hmm. People only ever remember your bad decisions, but I suppose maybe that's just life. You know, but I'll say one thing. Over time, old bullets like myself and Shapiro, you must have made more good decisions and bad decisions. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a job.
That's very true.
Because the industry's ruthless. Eh?
I reckon you must be about a 65-35 good versus bad decision over the couple of decades or whatever it is that you've been in the market, Wayne. Are you a 65-35er?
I don't know if it's that good. It's probably 70-30. Sorry, 60-40, the long way around. Probably 60-40. I don't think I'm a...
That's still good enough, as long as you manage it. The one thing that we will talk about one day is when to get out. I mean, you keep on going on about the PGM stocks.
That's the hardest decision.
Yeah, you say
to
yourself,
that's the hardest decision.
I can't. I went into these investments for all the right reasons, according to my analysis and the commodity cycle and interest rates and inflation and China and everything, but it's just not working and it hasn't worked now for 19 months. And you say, do I chuck it in now? That's the most difficult ever, I think.
Yes. Unless the thesis that you use to buy those shares is no longer valid. In other words, if tomorrow, for whatever reason, inflation starts going up again and up seriously, then my whole thesis of falling interest rates, falling inflation, global growth, investment cycle, commodity cycle is wrong. So if inflation in the US goes back to 10%, Then my theory is wrong. Then you sell. But if the base reason as to why you bought those investments is still valid, don't sell out. I mean, your clients might hate you. You might hate yourself, but don't sell out. And there's another good old-fashioned saying in investments, is that in most cases, if you hang on to something long enough, you probably end up being right.
That's very true. Yeah, that's where you have to have patience. Anyway, you're a patient man. You're an experienced man. You've got most of your decisions right compared to your losers, and got a bit of time on your hands so you don't have to sit in front of a screen watching every little flicker of every little index in every single investment jurisdiction in the world. I need to talk about something else, though, Wayne. I woke up this morning. Well, actually, I was woken up this morning by a lot of noise. Big thundering trucks going along the cobbled street in which I live, delivering things to the market square of Middelburg in Zeeland in the Netherlands, because it's the Mussel Festival. It starts tomorrow and it goes on for three days.
Oh, that's terribly exciting, Nick.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's a Mussel Festival and people come from
all
over.
And I hope you're going for all 3 days.
Wayne.
I hope you're going for all 3 days.
Wayne, You know, I'm not a sociable person. There will be, as I said earlier on in this interview.
You can sit there by yourself.
No, you see, there are so many people. It is clogged, as I said earlier, because of the school holidays. It's Germans, it's Belgians and French, and lovely people, and very good for the local economy, and Dutch, and a smattering of English, etc., that are here. The ones that can't go to Greece because it's too hot, they come here.
Yeah.
And almost every single, from what I understand, purveyors of food have to sell mussels during this festival time. And I got a letter through the post about a week ago from an organisation called the Gemeente, which is essentially the municipality. And it says, look, we're really sorry, but where you live, it's going to be noisy because you live near the square and everything. And you just have to put up with it for 3 days. But if you present this letter...
Just live with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you present this letter at any restaurant in Middelburg, you'll get a free bowl of mussels. So I will do that. I'll go around the corner and I'll say, here we are, my dear fellow, give me bowl of mussels.
Surprising enough, I'm not a very sociable person either. I'm actually an introvert. Lots of people say to me I'm the loudest introvert they've ever met because I'm not scared of public talking. But when I say I'm an introvert, I am extremely happy with my own company. I like company. We've got lots of friends. We do lots of socializing, but I'm not unhappy when I'm by myself. Now, to me, that's a definition of a bit of an introvert in that I don't have to have people around me to be happy and content and have fun. I can do that. I can work on cars. I'm quite happy with my own company.
Likewise.
But I don't mind crowds. So if I had a mussel festival down the road from me, I would be there all 3 days of the mussel festival. Don't have to talk to anyone. I don't have to join any crowd. But lots of people and lots of noise and background noise doesn't worry me. In fact, interestingly enough, the world's biggest rugby fan and I, what we found the worst about COVID and lockdown was not hearing any other background noise other than the little noise we make at home. So we go to restaurants, we go out, and we actually missed that sort of background noise of people talking and laughing and knife and fork music and glasses tinkling and people walking up and down and going in and out. We actually missed that. That was actually the one of the, and when restaurants opened, that was one of the things that was the best. You could go there and there were people and there was a bit of activity and a bit of background noise happening.
You see, I'm the opposite to that. I go to a restaurant at 6 o'clock in the evening, not 8 o'clock, because I don't want lots of people around me. I'm a sociophobe, and I'm becoming more so as I get older. I need to go and see someone about it, probably. But I need to seek some professional help here. But,
now, there was a restaurant up here in Parkmore years ago, donkeys ago. I mean, must be, probably 10, 13, 14 years ago, called Thomas Maxwell. It was a very nice restaurant
in a slightly dodgy area. I used to live in Parkmore.
Slightly dodgy area, but a fantastic restaurant. Was it, near Benmore?
Yes, near Benmore Garden Shopping Centre. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not good with suburbs and that. I didn't grow up in Joburg. And there was a Thomas Maxwell was there, and they served a bowl of curried mussels to die for. Delicious. And then a good friend of mine, we worked together at Momentum for donkey's years, and he actually just retired from Momentum last year. Him and I went to London, to our London office, probably 2003, 2004, and we stayed there together for a while. Now, he lived in London. He's a South African, but he lived in London for a number of years. So he knew all the little spots in London, and he took me to a Belgian restaurant there where they just served mussels.
Yeah.
You could either have mussels with wine and garlic or curried mussels, and they had long trestle tables. So you just went and got a spot at the trestle table, and you just said to the waiter, curry or the wine one, and you got a pot of mussels in front of you, and then you could order your beer and your wine and stuff. And if you were finished that pot and you wanted another one, you put your hand up and another pot came there. And when you were finished, you got up and you paid. So there weren't separate tables. You all sat in these long trestle tables that just had a roll of brown paper over the top of the table. So when you stood up, They just literally tore off your piece of brown paper if you've messed and put down another piece of brown paper. But it was truly fantastic.
Yeah, you see, I am going to go for my bowl of mussels, but I'm dreading it. Because you see, what happens is, Wayne, because I live near the market square and it's sort of a lot of bars and restaurants, people will stay until 1, 2 in the morning and there'll be a lot of noise and I won't be able to sleep. So I am fleeing to Amsterdam for a day and a half to get away from the noise. But that's just me. But anyway, I shall think of you with my mussels. I shall send you a picture. Wayne, thank you very much for your time as always. Wayne McCurry is from FMB Wealth and Investment. And that was Wayne on Wednesday. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.